I would now like to introduce our fourth old-timer, Kay, from Tuesday Lunchtime, Ascot. And Kay's first meeting was Saturday Hammersmith, where she met Liverpool Jimmy, who walked her home and talked about God. So, to No Nonsense Kay,
Hi, my name is Kay and I'm an alcoholic. And I got sober on the 1st of March 1975. And it was a horrible day. I was born in this country of a mother who was English and a father who was American Indian. When he got demobbed, we went and lived on the Cherokee Reservation outside of Tulsa, and we both starved 4 years. And the Red Cross brought us back, me and my mother, to England, to my grandmother in Manchester, where I spent a year in hospital being treated for malnutrition at the age of 7. And my mother spent 2 years in hospital being treated for malnutrition. And I came out of hospital 8 years old. I convalesced for a year with my grandmother, 9 years old, and went to school with 5 year olds. I didn't fit in, strangely enough, and had a lot of problems at school. I'd never been hit, and somebody broke a window, and somehow they thought it was me, and I had to go to the headmaster's office, and he said, put out your hand, and I did, and he hit me with a cane. So I took the cane off him and beat him about the head, which didn't go down very well. And I didn't understand why. So my schooling was very peculiar and a very odd experience for me. So I decided the way to do well was to come first and second in everything, which is what I did. And I took up sports and I became first and second at that. And I swam for the county and blah-de-blah-de-blah. My mother remarried and my father adopted me, so he's my adopted father. And at 13, my mother was in hospital again and my adopted father sexually molested me. I wasn't pleased about that. And I started to drink. At 14, I went to the pub and drank gin and oranges. And I had 2 large gin and oranges. And I felt so much better. I felt better than I'd ever felt in my life. And I went back to the pub, and back to the pub, and back to the pub. And I left school, and I got pregnant, and I got married, and I moved down to London. And I got pregnant again, and I had a second child, and I got divorced. Because I didn't really need him. I was quite independent. So I took my 2 kids and we went off to Notting Hill. Well, it was 1965 in Notting Hill. It was just after the race riots and just before the big hippy-dippy thing. So during the week, I worked at a big shop in Oxford Street. And at the weekend, I was what they called a weekend hippie, with the beads and the caftan and the yoga and all that stuff. And, you know, Lady Madonna with a baby on her hip. That was me. I was in Hyde Park when the Stones concert was on, selling dope like it was chalk ice. You know, do you want Nepali in black, or do you want temple balls, or do you want Congolese grass, or do you want some brandy, or, you know, I was there. I've always earned money. That's always been a big part of being independent, that I earn some dough. So this went quite well in Notting Hill, you know. There were restaurants opening. I used to go to the restaurant openings and didn't eat much, but there was always loads of stuff to drink, so that was great. And ran around with, you know, mobsters and all that shit, you know. Bellfruit machines were going into pubs, so I was round the pubs in the evening collecting the money, and it was some for me, some for the landlord, and a bit for Bellfruit. You know, it was stealing other people's money, going around in a 4.2 Jag with gutting knives and a shotgun and other people's money. And it was a good life. I didn't see anything wrong in it at all. And I was working, you know, paying tax during the week at my little shop job. So it was all rolling along, but I was getting more and more out of control. I would go out in the West End and not be able to get back. Taxis wouldn't take me because I was too drunk. I could walk so far, and then I had to go sleep in somebody's garden. And that wasn't very nice. And then the nights I did get home, I'd piss the bed or vomit in the bed or whatever it was, and that was just disgusting. My children got very out of hand. They really didn't like the fact that I was so unreliable. I didn't really care at that point. And then I found yoga, because good hippies do yoga. So I was there, you know, on and on and on. And I would feel, I'd feel my body vibrating from the alcohol. I was so sick inside. My body was physically vibrating. My head was thumping. And my heart was really, really racing. And I began to think that I might be doing myself some damage, because I'd been so fit. I'd been an athlete. So I did think about this, and I tried to stop, and then I didn't see any point in stopping, and all of that stuff that goes on when you can't, you know, make your mind up that you've got a problem. And then the social got interested in my son, because he was being out of hand at school. He was going into school, getting his mark, and then running away and doing other stuff. So I thought, well, maybe I should stop drinking. I tried, but not really. But I thought, yeah, I'm gonna stop drinking. So that Monday, I didn't drink. I used to do shop fitting. And this shop I worked for had 52 tradesmen, and I was their boss. And tradesmen love to drink, is my experience. So I didn't drink. I didn't go to the pub at lunchtime. I expected them to be back on time because I wasn't drinking. And the whole week was just a real uphill struggle. But I managed 5 days without drinking. At the end of the week, somebody was leaving from work, and I tidied up my paperwork, because not only was I not drinking, but I was being good as well. And went to the pub to say goodbye, and there were brandies up on the bar for me. Nobody that I knew wanted me to be sober. So I drank these, and I stayed in the pub till gone 11, and they were all going to stay behind for afters. But I wasn't welcome. And I had a fight with the landlord of the pub, and he threw me out onto Cavendish Square, and I straightened myself up, because I'm a very smart girl. I had my Jaeger camel coat and a very nice suit, and I straightened myself up and walked down Park Lane to the Hilton and went to the rooftop bar, where I often used to drink. Because in my drinking, I found drinking in hotels was great. Because you'd be there at the cocktail bar drinking, and the doorman would come up and say, "Excuse me, madam," and get hold of me by my arm. And he'd say, "Your car's waiting outside." And he would throw me out the front door into a taxi. But I thought that was quite good. That was better than most ways I got home anyway. So I went to the Hilton. And I was drinking in the cocktail bar, and somebody had a party in a suite, and they invited me to this party in the suite. Well, my idea of being at a party, because I'm a very social animal, the window ledges on the Hilton are as big as this table, and the curtains come round the front, so the window's that side and the curtain's this side. So I took a bottle of brandy off the bar and went and sat behind the curtains to get pissed. And that was my idea of being at a party. I don't know what happened after that. I have no clue what happened after that. But I came to underneath the arches at Charing Cross. I had been fighting. All my knuckles were skinned. My face was banged up. I had ladders in my tights, I'd pissed myself, there was blood down the front of my coat, I'd broken the heel on my shoe, and I was sitting on the floor underneath the arches at Charing Cross with the Dossers. And I just gave me pause for thought. I couldn't stand up. I was stuck there. And a taxi stopped. I was 29, quite a good-looking girl. And he said, "Are you all right?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Where do you live?" I said, I'd moved to Barons Court by then. I said, "Barons Court, Cromwell Road." And he said, "Have you got some money?" And I did have some money. So I said, "Yeah." So he said, "I'll take you home." So he took me back to my flat. I went in. My children, who were 9 and 11 by now, just looked at me in that way that children look at their drunken parents. Real disgust, real dislike, real, "Oh my God, she's done it again." And I just felt awful because I was actually, you know, suffering withdrawals. I had the dry heaves, the sweats, the shits, all of that stuff. And I just didn't know what to do. And my friend Josie phoned me up and she said, "Hello. How you doing?" I said, "I'm really hungover." She said, "Oh, good, come down the pub." I said, "No, I can't. I really can't." And I couldn't. I couldn't have gone down the pub. So I sat around and tried to drink water and kept throwing up and really was trembling and really feeling bad. And I phoned Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I have no idea why. Had no contact with Alcoholics Anonymous at all. So I phoned them and I cried. And the guy kept saying, "What's your name? Where do you live? I'm an alcoholic too." And I just going, and I couldn't speak. Could not speak. And I was on the phone for about 15 minutes. And he eventually got my name and where I lived. And he said, "Can you get to a meeting tonight?" And I said, "No, I don't think so." So when he finished his shift, he came to my flat, knocked on the door. My kids let him in. He washed my hands and face. He put my jacket on me. And he took me to Hammersmith. And Hammersmith at that time had a big half circular concourse with a big railing round it. And he attached me to the railing. And I stood there and waited for whoever was going to take me to the meeting, which turned out to be Liverpool Jimmy. And Jimmy came up and he said, "Are you okay?" I said, "No." "No." And they went round, all these women that were waiting for dates, saying, "Are you okay?" And they're all going, "No." Anyway, he got back round to me again, and I said, "No, not me." So he phoned home, central office, who then gave him my number. He phoned home, and my children told him what I was wearing. And he frog marched me to the meeting. So that's how willing I came to a meeting. They gave me a bucket and half a cup of coffee. And I knew they were fucking crazy because I was dry heaving all the time. But they, you know, and I'm there with this half a cup of coffee and a bucket, and sipping the coffee and being sick in the bucket. And they were talking about what they drank and where they drank it and the ice tinkling in the glass and, you know, the dramas of drinking. And I thought, they're all fucking mad. They were nearly all Irish or Scottish, you know, difficult CIA, all that stuff, no women. And I just thought, this is a load of shite. So it finished and Jimmy walked me home. And while he walked me home, he talked to me about God. Well, I'd met these people before. They come knocking on the front door, don't they? You know, "Do you believe in God?" "No, piss off." And Jimmy was going on and banging on and on and on. And we got home and he said, six doors down from where I lived, they'd opened an AA clubhouse. Never had one since, but they'd opened it. I swear it was for me. And he said, "You have to get to a meeting every day, and there is a clubhouse six doors down from where you live." So I said, "Oh, great." So I didn't sleep. I was crawling up the wall on my fingernails, and it was absolutely the worst night I've ever had. Being sick, couldn't keep anything down, shits, sweat. You know that smell? That horrible, sickly alcohol smell that comes out of you when you're just so full of alcohol. Really awful. So I went to this other meeting in the clubhouse, and it was the same geezers and all going on and on about what they drank, which just made me thirsty. I mean, it just made me thirsty. And then they sold me some books. I thought, oh, it's a book club. That's, you know, it's just like those people who knock on the door about God. You know, they say, do you believe in God? And then they give you a book, don't they? So I took the books and I went home, and I couldn't eat, I couldn't sleep. I was still throwing up. I was in a disgusting state. And Monday morning rolled round and the kids went to school. And I phoned up that central office and I told them, this doesn't work. This is a load of shite. I don't want your bloody books. Nah, 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 nah. And it was Mari. And she said, well, dear, why don't you come down to the central office? And we'll talk about it. Fucking will. Boof. And I'll get a cab and I'm down at central office and I'm marching there. And she says, just sit down there, dear, and put those things in the envelopes. So all day I'm putting fucking stuff in envelopes. Like this. And at the end of the day, she said, I'm going to Monday Wimbledon. You can come with me. So I said, all right. So I go to Monday Wimbledon, where I have an alcoholic fit. And I'm on the floor, shaking and throwing up and passing out. And they take me outside and they prop me up against the wall, and there was a doctor in that meeting. And he came out and he said to me, you need to go and see your doctor and you need to get admitted to hospital. And I said, no, I can't, because I've got two children and I don't want them to go into care because I'll never get them back. And he said, all right, go to your doctor and ask him for B12 and multivite shots. So I thought about that. I thought, okay. So I was up all night again and I'm thinking, I can't go back there because my doctor was African and black, and he had had the temerity to tell me previously that I was an alcoholic, and I had told him what he could do and what he couldn't do and how he could get there and his lack of parentage and anything else I could stick my tongue to. And he was telling me to go back to this man, and I did. I went back, I apologized, and I said, I think you're right, I am an alcoholic and I need to have B12 and multivite shots. So he found those and he gave me those in my backside, and then he got the script out and he said, Valium, Librium, Mogadon, you know, what? And I said, no, I've been told not to take those things, because if I take those things I'm going to have to come off them again, which is another addiction. So that's the first time in my life I think I actually did what I was told. Never before. Never happened before. I always did what I wanted to do, not what anybody wanted to tell me to do. So that was good. And I came out of the doctor's and I collapsed on the pavement and a taxi stopped and she took me down to, you know, Mari, and went to a meeting with Mari, and I just didn't like it. I didn't have any concept of what was going on. You know, he was in the Nuttach, he was in prison, he drank Guinness, he drank Scotch, he drank Johnny Walker Black Label, all of that shit, and I was sitting there dying for a drink, just dying for a drink, and that's all they were talking about. So Mighty Mouth here, on about my fourth meeting, opened up my big gob and said, you know, this is shit, I don't like it. I don't want to hear about what you drank and where you drank it. I want to know how you stay sober. So I went on banging on like this in meetings, going to a meeting every day, and I'm Archie Campbell. And he said, I'm starting a 12 and 12 step meeting in the West End on Saturday. So I said, well, I can't go to a meeting on Saturday because I've got two children and a full-time job and blah, blah, blah. And he said, did you drink on Saturdays? Did I? Yeah, it was a weekend. Of course I drank on Saturdays. He said, well, you can get to a meeting on Saturday then. So I got to the 12 and 12 step meeting where I learnt about those steps. Didn't like them. I had no control over alcohol, I knew that. But my life wasn't unmanageable. I hadn't been to the Nuttatch, I hadn't spent 3 months drying out, all that shit that goes on. Not me. So I didn't need the second half. My life was manageable, not unmanageable. So step two, yeah, I thought God could do for me, but I knew he wouldn't because he knew I was a little shit, so he wasn't going to do anything for me, but maybe. But I wasn't going to hand my will and my life over. No way. And I wasn't going to do step four and five because I'm not going to tell you lot what's wrong with me. And six and seven, maybe. Oh, eight and nine. I can go around and see all my old friends. Won't that be good? So first one was my adopted father. Got the kids ready, went down to Southampton and out to the New Forest to see him. Spent, an hour in his kitchen doing the, woe is me, what a drama my life has been, I'm an alcoholic, And he put dinner on the table and he gave me a glass of wine, which I didn't drink, but he hadn't understood anything I'd said at all and didn't want to understand because I'd just been a bloody nuisance all my life. So I came away from there and I was really upset. And my son threw a fit on the train and the whole thing had been a disaster. And I phoned somebody I knew in AA and she said, well, really you need a sponsor. Oh God, something else. So I was in the meetings, I was doing the teas, there was a tramp came in when I came in called Vince and his teeth didn't fit and he had cardboard in his shoes because he had holes in them. And me and Vince used to do the tea at Friday Mayfair, and it was a big table with big, big teapots. And every week he used to come in, and I used to say, "You still sober? Are you still sober?" And he'd go, "Sure I am." Spray me with spit. And I used to think, how the bloody hell does he stay sober? If he can stay sober, I can stay sober. He was living on the streets. So this went on, and then I met Archie, and he said he's starting a 12-step meeting. So I got to this 12-step meeting, and it was amazing. It was very disruptive. There were a lot of people back then who didn't want, you don't need the 12 and 12. You only need the big book. There's a few of them left now, but they're dinosaurs, You need whatever literature you need. So they were at the back of the meeting shouting the odds. And we were trying to have a meeting about this step meeting thing. And it was amazing. People were actually talking about how they lived sober. Now, I didn't know how to do that. I had no clue of how to live without a drink. So first of all, they said it's one day at a time. And if you can't do a day, it's just 10 minutes. You're not going to have a drink for another 10 minutes. And another 10 minutes. So I thought, that's good. And if you're really in trouble, say the serenity prayer. God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So I took on the serenity prayer, and I took on the day at a time or an hour at a time, and restart your day at any time. A bit further on, I was outside John Lewis's with bolts of fabric and a briefcase and a handbag. It was pissing down with rain, and I was trying to get a taxi. Now, when it's raining in Oxford Street, you cannot get a taxi. So I'm wandering up and down, and I caught sight of myself, because I'm muttering to myself, God grant me the serenity, and got all this gear. And I looked like a bag lady. I caught sight of myself in the window. You still look fucking bonkers, Kay, absolutely mad. So I started trying to moderate my behaviour when I'm on the street. It's just odd little things. So I was jealous too, because there were people who'd spent 3 months in treatment. I had to get sober, get back to work, sort my kids out, sort the flat out. You know, I mean, it was all too much. And you lot had had 3 months in treatment in, you know, with Max Glatt or whoever it was. And I was really pissed off about that. Really pissed off. But I had to get on with it. So, at this step meeting, some woman had shared that she did not beat up her kids or lock them in the cupboard under the stairs, but that she emotionally neglected her children. And I knew right in my heart, I knew that's what I'd done. So I thought, that's it, I'm going to ask her to be my sponsor. And she was American, so that was nice. So I asked her and she said no. So I asked her again and she said no. And I asked her again and she said no. And I asked her again and she said no. And I asked her again and she said she'd give me an hour a week. So, before the Thursday night meeting in Horseferrow Road, I used to go and meet her in a caff, and for 45 minutes I would tell her what shit my life was, and for 15 minutes she'd tell me about the program. And it was that hot summer, that hot, hot summer. And suddenly, everybody's out on the street, drinking. And I've got to walk through all this to get to Victoria. So that was really, really, I thought, what is God doing to me? That is really a bad move. So I used to get down there in not a very good mood, and then we would go to the meeting. And slowly, 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 I came to realize how unmanageable my life and I am. Not only is my life unmanageable, I was totally unmanageable. And it was an amazing revelation. So I went on going to this meeting, and it was just like, I don't know, it was an eye-opener, it was a new thing, it was something totally different. So I took this program, and I do 1, 2, and 3 every morning before I get out of bed. I can't, he can, and I will let him. And that's before I do anything in the morning. Because I know that this head doesn't work for me. And it never will. So I can't, he can, and I will let him. 1, 2, 3. And then I did 4 and 5. My first 4 and 5 was a précis of Anna Karenina in the snowy wastes with her 2 children. Adapted to Notting Hill. And my sponsor had gone back to America for the summer, and I sent my fourth step away for her to read, and she sent me back a one-sheet letter that said, "Dear Kay, I too was a liar." Really? Didn't like that. So she came back and I said, look, you know, I'm going to these meetings, I've stopped drinking, I'm looking after my kids, I'm doing my job, and nothing's going right. And she said, there are no bouquets for stopping drinking. You never could drink, you've always been a drunk, you've admitted that to me, you've always been a drunk. When it took 2 gins, it was 2 gins, and when it was 2 bottles, it was 2 bottles. I've never had a social drink in my life. She said, and you told me that. So there's no reward for not drinking. It's what you actually do with your sobriety. That's the reward. So I didn't like that. Didn't see her for a couple of weeks, like you do with your sponsor, when they say something you don't like. So I went away, talked to other people about, what do you think? Don't trust anybody. So I did 4 and 5 and 4 and 5 and 4 and 5 until eventually I got to the truth, and the truth was that I was the manufacturer of my own destruction. I was. Not my father, not my mother, not my grandmother, not my teachers, not my employers, not my lovers, not my children, me. Me. I'm the person who spoiled my life. I'm the person who drank. I'm the person who made myself sick. Me. And that's a hard pill to swallow. I thought I was this lady about town bringing up my children beautifully, and it turned out I was this old slag dragging my children through the gutter with me. And I didn't like that. Didn't like that at all. But that's the truth. That's the way it was. I had no regard for anybody except me. So, having found the truth, 6 and 7, things that I didn't do that I should do, like being responsible, being on time, being trustworthy, being honest, being loving, being kind, all that stuff, that's all stuff I didn't do. The things I did do, like ferociously angry, always working on adrenaline and anger and driving fast and other people's money and dishonesty and all of that stuff, became the stuff that I did do that I was supposed to stop. And the things that I didn't do that I was supposed to pick up. To be consistent was the first thing I learned. To be consistent, to do the same things every day, the prayers and meditation, the looking after the kids, the turning up at work, the coming home, the feeding them, the going to meetings, the washing, the ironing, the cleaning, the decorating, the everything. Just to be consistent, to do something every day. It was really hard, really hard. So I tried to be consistent. Things were popping along a bit, you know. I was nearly 5 years sober. I thought, oh, getting there. And my son got hit by a bus. He ran out of school in a temper, and he got hit by a bus. And he was in hospital, and the police phoned me at work and said, you know, you better come down to Hammersmith Hospital. And I left work, and I got in the taxi, and I told the guy what gear to drive in, what lane to drive in, what colour the lights were, don't bother stopping at the zebra crossing, run the fucker over, go faster, all of that. On and on and on and on until I got to the hospital. I got out at the hospital, went up to the children's ward, and they wouldn't let me see him. Because I was in such a state, uncontrollable rage and anger and frustration and crying and all of that, they wouldn't let me see my son because he was too ill to see somebody like that. And I came away from there and I went home and I slammed the front door and I just sat on the floor and cried. And I phoned my sponsor because I wanted some sympathy. Did I get sympathy? No. Because sympathy kills alcoholics. You'll find it in the dictionary between shit and syphilis. So I found my sponsor and she says to me, you're supposed to be the adult, Kay. Cheeky bitch. Put the phone down on her. But I thought about it. Because I'm not shoving anything up my nose or taking any medication or any of that crap that people do in AA. It stayed in my head. Yes, I'm the parent. I'm supposed to be the adult. So I washed my face and I calmed myself down and I said a few prayers and I went back up the hospital and they let me see my son. All these things that happen, these dramas that we love, are to teach us something, teach me something about this program. And it went on. And amends, oh God. I ran around with some real rough people. And in particular, my foreman carpenter at work, he had a motorbike. And we used to have mad day out, which consisted of me getting on the back of his bike, us going to some pub, causing a fight, smashing the pub up, and leaving before the police arrived. That was our idea of a day out. We thought that was great. And I had led him astray many a time. So there was him. I didn't want to see him again, ever. There were people to do with Belfruit, real gangsters, that I didn't want to see again. And there were easy people, like my children, that I'm still making amends to. Because making amends isn't saying you're sorry, it's changing your behaviour. So I'm still making amends to my kids. And my boyfriend at the time, my boyfriend was my yoga teacher, which is part of the reason that I'm here, because if I hadn't done meditation, I wouldn't know how sick I was. And he moved in when I got sober, and moved out when he found I didn't want to drink. So that was easy. I made amends to him. He got very sick in the end, and I used to go down and see him and give him a few bob and buy him some fags, and he was in an old people's home, but he was in a bad way, and died of sclerosis of the liver. There was a Russian girl I used to drink with, and I was walking along Oxford Street one day about 4 or 5 years after I'd stopped drinking, and this voice from the pavement came to me and said, "Hello, Kay, how are you?" And it was Marushka, and she was living on the pavement in plastic bags. And I took her home with me, and I gave her a bed, which she pissed in and vomited in and bled in. And eventually I got her into a drying out centre. And my children were not happy about that, but I explained to them that I have to do this. This is not a choice. I have to do this. I've been given an amazing gift, and I have to give it away in order to keep it. And I'm a greedy, greedy alcoholic. I want to keep everything I've been given. So I have to give it away. And it works. So amends, you know, the foreman carpenter, I met him in Oxford Street one day, and his wife was very ill, and I looked after his twin girls for about 18 months while his wife was having operations and things, and when she got better, they went back to their parents. But I was able to help. That was an amend. No good telling you I'm sorry. It doesn't mean anything, does it? Number of times we say sorry, it's, you know, you can't blame people. You really can't. We drive people around the twist. So, what else? Got better jobs. Became reliable, employable. Made amends to the company I've been working for. Did a lot of overtime to make up for the time I'd stolen from them. I worked for them for another 10 years and did a lot of extra work. And I got a really good job, you know, with car and sickness benefits and, oh, you know, all the crap, phones, and I hate phones. Anyway, you know, phone in the car, all that shit. And it worked well. You know, the kids did well out of it. I did well out of it. They came of an age where they needed driving lessons, and I had the money for it, and cars, and I had the money for that. And it was just amazing to me. And then in 92, there was another recession, wasn't there? And I just bought a house. And I had a new mortgage. And I couldn't get a job. And I went and signed on. And I prayed. I don't pray like you lot. I tell God exactly what I'm thinking. Because I think God is within and without. And if I'm thinking, "You stupid bastard, you've gone on holiday," it's no good me going, "Thee and thou, most holy Father," because I really do think God knows what you're doing. And so he gets it straight from me. And I meditate. I meditate a lot. I've meditated too much in my day. When I was first sober, I used to love meditation. I used to shut the bedroom door and say to the children, "Mummy's meditating. I'll be out in 2 hours." And it was lovely when you're a single parent. 2 hours of peace and quiet is amazing. But I learned to do 20 minutes instead, because that's much more. See, I'll go over the board on anything. Doesn't matter what it is, whether it's chocolate, men, work, money, doesn't matter what it is. Finding that balance is really, really difficult for me. And still is. So, yep, my dad. If I'm going to forgive me, I have to forgive my dad. It's no good me having resentments. Doesn't mean I have to love everybody. I've heard that in AA, but nah, I don't think so. There are people I don't want in my life. There are nutters that I definitely don't want in my life. I'll help anybody, but you prove to me you're a real nutter and gotta go. And that's okay too, because I've got to look after my life. I've got to look after me. God won't do for me what I can do for myself. So I looked after my children. I kept nutters away from my children, finally, once I got sober. And all of that stuff that goes on is just amazing to me, because my first sponsor told me to grab opportunity by the forelock because it is ball behind. So if I get an opportunity that I have not looked for or worked for, and somebody offers me an opportunity, I will take it. I went to work in America a few years ago, about 10 years ago now, because I couldn't find a job, so I went cleaning. I live in Windsor, and when I told people I'd gone cleaning, they said, oh, you're starting your own company? I said, no, I'm cleaning other people's toilets. That's what I'm doing. And they thought that was terrible, but that's me. I'll do whatever it takes, and I believe in that. You do whatever it takes. So I went cleaning, and from cleaning, somebody asked me to go housekeeping for them. That was nice. Big house, big garden. They're hardly there. Fantastic. There every day, polishing the copper saucepans. It was a bit different. So that was nice. And then they were moving down to Brighton, and I wasn't going to move down to Brighton. So found another job with an American couple. They were multimillionaires. That was even better. They were there even less. It was fantastic. And because I was honest and all the rest of it, I was using their money. I had a bank account with their money in. I was paying all their bills and chauffeurs and gardeners and then and then and that. Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. I would never have done that out of choice. It was just things that happened to me. And that set me up with money for my mortgage, money for my pension, money for my kids. It was just amazing. Right at the end of my life, that all happened. And then I went to work in America with them. That was traumatic in the extreme. Her husband got murdered by her boyfriend, and she made me guardian of her children, and the family were going nuts, and the police were going nuts, and the guy who'd murdered the husband was trying to get a contract out on me, and it was all like, wee! And they all said to me, you're really calm in the middle of this. I said, yeah, I'm in God's hands, not in your hands. I'm in God's hands. And it was amazing. And I sailed through all that by minding my own business. What went on with her and her boyfriend and the father and the money and it was none of my business. I just looked after my bit of it, my little bit. In Scotland they say, tend your own knitting, and that was what I did. And it was amazing. It was an amazing trip. Very intense. Very tiring, very emotional. And in the end, I did some terminal nursing with her. She died of cancer. And I came home. And it's only about 4 years ago I finished with the money, because I was guardian of the money. And it's amazing. Me, guardian of somebody's money. Me, who was stealing off Bellfruit. It's just incredible what this program does. I have a wonderful, wonderful relationship with my children. My son is married, don't like his wife, but what does that, nothing new in that, is there? And she's a banker and thinks she rules the world and knows the right way to do everything. And she had twins, boy-girl twins. They're 14 now. I loved them till they became 14, and now they're horrible teenagers. Don't really like them now. That's all right. My daughter, husband died 4 years ago. Stevie was 50 years old watching the television, and he had a massive heart attack on the couch when she was away working, and she got home to find a dead body there, and I was able to help her through that. But help her, not take over, not be in the way, but really help her. His family came down. He's from the Gorbals in Glasgow. Jesus. They came down in one of those people carriers that had more crates of booze in than you'd see in a pub. And they stopped outside her house. They unloaded this mountain of booze. It was like, whoa. And they drank the whole 6 days they were there. And it was, I know why I don't want to drink. When I look at them, I know I don't want to be like that. It was horrible, because half the time they were crying and the other half the time they were fighting. We don't have massive fights anymore. We really don't. We haven't had a row in my family since the baby's christening. That's 14 years ago. Because my son wanted to invite his father and his father's new wife and their four kids. And I said, no, I'm not playing happy families with that man unless he wants to give me about 30 grand for bringing you up on my own. He paid fuck all, so I'm not going to play happy families with him. And people said, ooh, you've got to try. I don't have to try. I really don't have to try. That's my decision. And my son and his wife went garrity. And that's all right. That's their privilege. And I went and worked in America. So I got out of the situation, did a geographical. And it was about 2 years in, and he phoned me up almost in tears, and he said, I'm sorry. I said, why? What's up? He says, it's really hard bringing up kids, isn't it? I said, yeah, try it on your own. There's two of you. So that's all lovely again now. So it's not that we haven't had bumps along the way. We have. But it's been a trip. I always thought this was going to be incredibly boring. You see people up here, don't you? Oh, I never do anything else. Yeah. My shit doesn't smell anymore. Well, mine does. And I'm really real, and I like to keep it real. I don't want to be good. I want to be well, really well. I love the 12 and 12. At the end it says, the joy of living is the result of these steps. And I really am happy, genuinely happy. And I'm going on holiday soon. And whenever I get back to AA, it's really funny because people come up and go, oh, you've been on holiday, haven't you? You've had a really good time again, haven't you? And it's like, yeah, I have. Because I love it. I really know what I like and what I don't like. And pertinent to that is step 10. I do a written step 10 every day. And it's not long. It's just, I'm feeling like shit because blah, 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 blah. Or I'm feeling really great because blah, 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 blah. And over a long period of time, every year, I pick one thing that I'm going to work on the next year. And sometimes it's kids, sometimes it's money, sometimes it's jobs, sometimes it's overeating because I love my food, sometimes it's the car, sometimes it can be anything. But whatever has given me the most trouble throughout the year is going to get fixed in the next year. And it keeps my sobriety going forward. It keeps me striving for something. And that's amazing to me. I feel better now at nearly 70 years old than I felt in my 30s. And I have five illnesses. I'm deaf, I've got keratinitis, diverticulitis, arthritis, and bronchitis. Do I care? No. I've cheated death for years. I should be dead, and I'm not. And it is due to this program. And I do it every day. Why wouldn't I? Why wouldn't I do it every day? Because it's given me everything that I have. I've bought a house. I've bought half a house for each child. I've just bought my daughter a car. I bought a new car for me this year. I had a Toyota Corolla for 15 years, didn't give me any trouble at all. It just went and stopped, and it was lovely. And people used to say to me, you know, because they're a bit like that in Windsor, "You want a new car?" No, this car does what I want it to do. It goes, it stops, it has a heater, the radio works, it's fine. 15 years, the bottom fell out of it. And I thought, well, that's the time to buy a new car, okay. So I bought myself a new car. And it is, my life is so abundant now. I have a lovely garden. I have two rescue dogs, one from Battersea, one from somebody in AA who was drinking. And it's whatever comes along. I'm open to opportunity. And I get lots of them, amazingly. But I have to look after me physically, mentally, and spiritually. If physically I just let myself go, bleh, I'm not going to be able to get about. Mentally, if I don't strain this a bit and try and keep it working, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to remember. I'm not going to know where to go. And spiritually, I always, I am a God botherer. I've been a God botherer since I got sober. I'm a God botherer 24/7. If I'm awake, I'm probably bothering God. I have a stair lift now because I have metal hips and all that, and I have a stair lift. And it takes ages to get upstairs. And I have no patience. You may have gathered that. I have no patience. So I sit there and I do my prayers on the stair lift. And it's fantastic. So everything I have kind of dovetails into my program. And if it doesn't dovetail into my program, it can fuck off. Very easy. Simple life for a simple person. And it's fantastic. And I have taken chances and it's worked. It's just amazing to me. My doctor sees me every 6 months and she keeps saying, you know, you're going to have a heart attack or you're going to have a stroke. And and I go, you don't know that. You didn't take my blood pressure till I was 50. I may have always had high blood pressure. You don't know. And when I had my hips done, you know, I said, when can I get out of here? The day of the operation, I'm saying, when can I get out of here? And they said, when you can go up and downstairs on crutches. So that same night, I'm upstairs on crutches. Because I don't want to be dependent. I don't want to be a burden. I want to be fit. I want to be well. Every way. Physically, mentally, and spiritually. And this program gives me a chance. Somebody who was hopeless and helpless and a mess. It gives me a chance. And it is brilliant. I'm seeing somebody tomorrow that I've been sponsoring for 28 years. And we have a shorthand now. And that is fabulous too. Oh, and the other thing I wanted to say is about self-pity. Because I had a lot of self-pity. Because I had two kids and no husband. And nobody to look after me. And no money and all that shit. And so I had a lot of self-pity. And I used to cry a lot when I first came to meetings, you know. My name's Kate, and I'm an alcoholic. And my sponsor said, for goodness sake, stop crying in meetings and go and cry in your bedroom. Ooh, I will. So first time I did it, I'm sitting in front of the dressing table with the mirror, you know. And I'm trying to do the, you know, like they do on the films where the tear just runs down. No, the snot came down. Oh, it was horrible. So I did 5 minutes of that and never done it since. And then I had the self-pity, you see. Nobody knows the troubles I seed. And she said, nah. She said, if you're going to be self-piteous, you go in your bedroom and you get 10 minutes. 10 minutes? Yep. And then you got to give it up and get on with life. So I started doing that, and that is an amazing exercise. It's lovely to wallow for 10 minutes. My son got run over again, by the way, and nearly died, and that was a whole other story. So I was very sorry for myself then. And those words come back, you know. Go in your bedroom for 10 minutes. Lie on the bed, you know. Do the whole, and then get up and get on with it. It's a fabulous life. It really is a fabulous life. And how lucky are we? We're the lucky few. Really are. I am so grateful and happy to be a part of this. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Oh, thank you very much, Kay. That was very good. Right, we're going to have a short break for, 15 minutes for tea and coffee. And there's also cold drinks in the back and that food outside. So we'll give it